Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cathal Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through WCTCAM or RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
I'm pretty darn well. Thank you very much.
Pretty darn well, huh? Mm-hmm. All right. I have some stuff I want to talk about, and Francis and I have not talked about this in advance, although I'm sure we've talked about it many times because, well, our desks are next to each other in the office. But I've been having some real difficulty with, I guess, what we'd call truth in advertising.
Mm.
I think there's a lot of products out there bending the truth.
For example,
there is a commercial on the radio for Bubba Burgers. Okay? And Bubba Burgers' credo, motto, is you'll never bite a burger better than a Bubba.
And I think,
well, you probably will.
You know, I have to say, you and I are in a rare moment where you and I are going to disagree.
Okay.
I think when you make claims like, we're the best ever, I think those kind of claims are understood to be a hyperbole.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we say our burgers are the best burgers in New Jersey, it's not hyperbole, but I think most people assume it is hyperbole.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about comparing them to our to fine dining, high-end, best burger in New Jersey. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about this is a frozen burger that you buy in a supermarket, and comparing that to a burger that you would go to a family butcher, and he would grind the burger meat for you, and put the right cuts in and put the however fat content you want and do it to your specs like a butcher would.
You think that's better than a frozen patty?
Is better than a patty that goes into, first of all, it's fresh as right. opposed to frozen. So it's probably going to be better anyway.
Right. No, it's going to be better anyway. Come on.
Well, 99% of the time.
But the burger, the claims that you're the best, we're the best, we're the tastiest, I don't really have any problem with that because I really think that they're meaningless claims, and everyone sort of understands that they're meaningless claims and understands that everyone thinks that theirs is the best or is willing to lie about it even though they know that theirs is not. I will always remember, just to go back for a moment, there was a company that makes a famous sort of faux juice that contains real fruit juice, but it's a company, and they were the big executives from this big wealthy company that makes this. And we thought, well, you know what? Well, we do kind of crazy things when people come in to sort of personalize the experience for them. And we made, using this fake juice that, you know, contains 10% mm-hmm. real fruit juice kind of juice, we made a cocktail or two. And they were like, why would we drink that? This stuff sucks. You know, and they're probably having a meeting to be there to talk about how to convince America that it was great. Yeah. Well, they know it sucks, and they would never drink it.
Oh, I remember we made a sorbet out of it. We did a couple of things with it.
They didn't want any of it.
And just so you know, none of it was as good as, you know, using real juice or using just none of it was anywhere near as good, just
yep.
like it's one
yep.
of those products that I don't understand why anybody ever buys.
Well,
but I have one for you.
Okay.
Okay. That I think might get under your skin a little bit more than that.
Okay.
Okay. It's Heinz ketchup.
Yep.
Ready?
Yep.
Their new slogan?
Yeah.
Grown, not made.
Yeah.
Except it's not tomatoes. It's Heinz tomato are grown. Yes,
yeah.
I agree. And what they said is all of our tomatoes are grown from Heinz seed. No problem with any of that.
All tomatoes are grown from some seed.
And frankly, I don't have a problem with ketchup, okay? Except for the corn, the high fructose corn syrup in there. You know, you can take that out. And actually, Heinz makes an organic ketchup that doesn't have a high fructose corn syrup in it. Fine. There's ketchup in my refrigerator right as we speak, Heinz ketchup, okay? But don't say grown and not made, okay? Because you know what ketchup is?
Made.
Made. Okay.
I'm going to embarrass my sister. My sister is a Superior Court judge, graduated valedictorian of her law school class, finished college in 3 years instead of four, and is one of the smartest people I know,
mm-hmm.
Except in some areas. And we were sitting, I guess she must have been, I must have been 15, and so she must have been 25. and we were sitting in the living room watching TV, and she was sort of half reading a book and half watching television. And there was, do you remember the old spaghetti commercials? I forget what brand it was.
You've told the story. You've told the story to our audience, but tell it again because it's a good one.
And there's spaghetti that they would pick off the trees, like mm-hmm. the harvest at whatever, and they pick spaghetti off the trees. It was a joke. And this commercial went on there for a year, and Francine just sits bolt upright in the couch and says, "Wait a second. Spaghetti doesn't grow on trees."
And neither does money, okay? Just that's not how it works.
Well, you know, here's the deal. I mean, you have a similar thing that goes on with the Lay's potato chips. They're like, our local mm-hmm. farmers supply the potatoes for the Lay's potato chips. All right, look, everything comes from a farm somewhere. Is it a huge corporate agribusiness factory farm that happens to be near a Lay's plant? You know, I'm not saying that it is. What I'm saying is there's a difference between saying Heinz tomato ketchup comes from tomatoes that are grown. Yeah?
No, but it doesn't even say it comes. Right, it says right. Their slogan is grown, not made. And I do understand. Obviously, there are tomatoes in Heinz ketchup.
Right.
Okay? And again, it's hard for, you know, I'm not going to badmouth Heinz ketchup any except for their slogan because it's the ketchup
it's
that
my
family uses.
Ketchup. Yeah, I'm with
okay?
you.
Okay, so.
Well, but you know what? I understand a little bit of what they're saying as well because as far as processed foods go, I would think that ketchup would be less processed than Pop-Tarts?
Less processed than Pop-Tarts, you win.
You know?
Okay, but it is not, as Ronald Reagan said,
a vegetable.
Okay? One of the great...
And you're a Republican.
One of the great all-time... You know, school lunch, you're having a problem funding it. It says here that we have to supply a vegetable.
No. Wasn't there a problem funding is they wanted to cheap out, and they were being there
right.
like, oh, this vegetable stuff is costing us money, and Ronald Reagan's like... Yeah, ketchup's a vegetable. Take all the vegetables off. Serve the kids crap. I have to say, I do like Heinz ketchup. I think that is there is a growing movement among the big corporations who understand that people want to feel a connection to where their food comes from, to not actually provide a connection to where your food
right,
comes from.
Right, I was going to say, but let me help you. No matter what Heinz does, we're never going to be connected to the tomatoes at the Heinz ketchup.
Well, I mean, Heinz could theoretically spin off small local ketchup plants that use local tomatoes.
Yes, they could.
But they aren't. They're just
no, they won't.
But it's the same. It's the same thing that they're just trying to co-opt the message.
Mm-hmm.
And the unfair part about that, and the unfortunate part about that, and why you listening people need to be smart, and while we in the restaurant business need to be smart about that, is to say. We can't. What they're trying to do is glom onto the image of these local farmers and small producers who are actually trying to provide a connection to your food. And what they do is they cheapen that person's message and they try and take away the message by taking away the very words that people use to communicate that, you know, hey, maybe your local farm stand put up some tomatoes and made a ketchup.
Right, the peach pie at the festival that you go to that's made on the farm, you know.
Right, that's grown, not made. You know. I think that's wild. Well, in any event, I agree. I think there are a bunch of gray areas here, but that just means that you need to be smarter and keep listening to shows like The Restaurant Guys. Hey, listen, we're going to come back and talk about vodka, which is something that you've heard us bash on the show a number of times. But we had some really interesting revelations about vodka down at Tales of the Cocktail, and there's been a vodka project that I've actually been involved in for 2.5 years since before it became a brand, and we're going to have the distiller, a really interesting guy named Malcolm Lloyd, come talk about what's going on in the vodka world. And the hook phrase to bring you back on the other side of the break is what everyone said about vodka in New Orleans was they said, we had to kill vodka so that we could save it, and now it's time to save it. So I think it's an interesting concept. We'll talk to Malcolm Lloyd about that in a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. And our guest today is Malcolm Lloyd. Malcolm is the owner of a vodka company, Double Cross Vodka, and you've heard us bash vodka in the past on this show. And as I mentioned before the break, the watchword down in New Orleans at Tales of the Cocktail, there's been a resurgence of interest in quality vodka and quality vodka cocktails. And what everyone was saying was that, you know, the initial animosity toward vodka was because everyone was drinking only vodka, that we had to kill vodka so that we could save it. And now one of the people out to save vodka is Malcolm Lloyd.
Malcolm, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, Malcolm, I've been involved, and we should, in the spirit of full disclosure, we should let our audience know that I've sort of been at least tangentially involved with this product since before you had a product line. When you were doing tastings in New York, you had a bunch of fancy cocktail, wine, and spirits types over to guide you before the product was even complete, right?
And Francis.
And Francis, right, exactly. So,
correct.
So tell us about the development of a vodka brand. What did you bring to the market? How did it work? Where did that tasting fit into your product development? And how does that all work?
Absolutely. Well, to perhaps co-opt you even further, Francis, I could go so far as to say that you were instrumental in helping us select the final formula for Double Cross. Because that tasting that Dale DeGroff had put together was because at the time I really didn't trust my own palate. I wanted to go to experts like yourself and Dale and the others. We had Julie Reiner and Dushan and the other folks we had around that table. And we had found some phenomenal people and phenomenal distilleries over in Eastern Europe. And we had some formulas that we wanted to have essentially tasted by folks like yourself who knew more about aroma and flavor than I thought I did. So that was a very important day for us, and we selected one out of three that more or less won the sort of the taste competition, if you want to call it that, when we got together at the 21 Club in New York.
No wonder I like it. I chose it. But how long does it take to develop a vodka brand? And I think one of the things that we've really talked about in the past is how, the legal definition of vodka is a flavorless, odorless spirit, right? But it's not quite flavorless or odorless, and there are textural components that really differentiate great vodkas. What are some of the things that you look for, and what are some of the things that, honestly, look, I don't think Grey Goose is worth the money for what they charge. There are vodkas that I like. I've always said that I thought Ketel One was really a great vodka. There are issues of using vodka in cocktails, and I think when you use a vodka in a drink that has pineapple juice and orange juice.
Right, a vodka cranberry apple mixture is not going to. It doesn't matter that much
vodka
what vodka's in there.
But the vodka itself, and there is a whole school of drinks that people were really talking about in New Orleans, like Dale DeGroff's Flame of Love Martini, things where we make a 50-50 with vodka, which is really great. We use Dolan Vermouth. There are drinks that are made where you preserve the texture of the vodka, and you can sort of, you can push whiskey around, and it sings loud in the choir. But vodka, right. You sort of need to, you can nudge a little bit this way, and you can accent a little bit that way, but what makes a great vodka that we're going to make in a drink like that where we preserve the texture and character of the vodka? What makes a great vodka a great vodka?
Well, I think you've touched on a lot of the things that I couldn't agree more with. I mean, even earlier on you were saying that you had to sort of kill vodka to let it live, and I've seen the over-commercialization of the category, and it's been sometimes at times painful to watch and painful to sort of operate in and be able to raise your hand and get any attention. In addition, there hasn't, it's a paradoxical position that vodka has, because because many people actually look to it for the absence of things, the absence of a hangover, the absence of impurities, the absence of odor, the absence of taste. And I think the reality is that if you line up a number of different low to high quality vodkas against one another, you're going to find that there are a tremendous number of nuanced differences. And I completely agree, Mark, with what you said, that if you push vodka around too much with some of the other things you can add to it, whether they're fruit juices or perhaps more savory ingredients, you can begin to dumb down those nuances. And I think it takes a real special mixologist who really understands vodka to be able to tell the differences and illuminate and highlight those differences between one and another.
I think
are differences between the general differences to look at, looking at it from a sort of macro perspective, where I find potato vodkas to be different than I find wheat vodkas to be. Potato tends to be a little bit more viscous. It's got a little bit of a sweeter more lingering, cloying kind of effect on the palate, where I find grain to be perhaps a bit crisper, a little bit more minerally. I feel that grain is best for, in my opinion, as like some of the cocktails you were just mentioning. The Flame of Love that Dale DeGroff makes is excellent with our grain product, our winter wheat product, as is the Dolan's 50-50 cocktail that you make at Stage Left.
Now, when people are looking for a good vodka, one of the things that I find is, you know, you really need to try vodka straight. Now there are two kinds of vodka drinkers out there, and we have to separate them. One is, you know, I want vodka and fruit juice because I really don't like the taste of alcohol, and I want to taste basically fruit juice, but I want to get a little buzz. Okay, for that kind of person, I think the magazine ad, there are two reasons to buy one vodka over another. One is the magazine ad convinces you that you're cool if you buy the one, and the other is to get the cheapest drink you can possibly get without getting a
hangover. Not just that. I think in that situation what you want to find is the lightest, simplest, most nondescript vodka you can find as well.
But the other kind of cocktails we're talking about now are serious cocktailians are taking vodka seriously, and also people, of course, who drink vodka straight or on the rocks. But what is it, texture mostly, that you find? Because for me, what the most striking thing about Double Cross, and it's one of my favorite vodkas, and I have some others that I really do like, it's a textural thing as much as a nuance of flavor. How do you wind up with a vodka? Some of them, when I say textural, with some vodkas like Double Cross, you get this, a critic would describe it as a rich mouthfeel. I mean, to put it in simple terms, it feels thick on your palate almost. It feels thicker on your palate. How is that achieved, and what is that a sign of?
Well, I think you know, it's you have to start with the basics of how the vodka is created and what the ingredients are. And for us, we had a couple of different choices we could make. We could have said we want to you know, guide the master distiller to create a vodka that's so watered down and smooth that, you know, everyone can throw it in any sort of mixer and it almost tastes like water. The other alternative was to sort of leave some of the flavor both in the water and from the fermentation process in the product and not in effect strip it all away. And that we sort of chose more the latter than the former of those two approaches. And one of the most important things that I think is that this distillery does is they take deep mountain spring water, which is rich in minerals. They then strip out those minerals, keep them in a holding tank, and then add back a very specialized formula that I think adds to that sort of that medium to sort of large mouth burst feel that you described, Francis.
Francis talks about texture a lot when he's talking about Double Cross, but there's a different quality, and I don't want to over-romanticize it in the way I describe it, but I don't have a better way to describe it. When I taste Double Cross vodka, the smell and taste that I get are very similar to me. The best way I can describe it is right after a lightning storm or one of, like a summer rain, where you get there's that kind of electrical feel and taste in the air.
Kind of a slaty minerality.
I get that when I taste Double Cross. Where does that come from?
I think you're picking up those minerals that are added back in to the vodka to add a bit of character and sort of flavor. And they come, you know, deep from the earth. So what you're picking up on is not something that a lot of people are able to pick up on, but I think you're spot on with understanding sort of what they're trying to accomplish what we're trying to accomplish with this product.
All right, now we're going to take a quick break, but I want to come back on the other side and I want to talk about where vodka is in the world right now and where vodka is in the cocktail world, because you were down, we had spent some time together in New Orleans at Tales of the Cocktail. And it's really on the precipice of a change. In how the market perceives it. And you're sort of out there in your own unique spot in the market. And I want to talk about how that's playing out, because I'm fascinated by it. But we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and on restaurantguysradio.com. You know, restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass, but I often find that a great glass of wine I order in a restaurant comes to me flat or even spoiled. It's been my experience as a restaurateur that wine preservation systems just don't work, until now. Now, Mark and I have searched for 20 years, and we finally found a wine preservation system that does work. Vinfinity system for restaurants and bars. Vinfinity keeps bottles of wine tasting fresh for weeks. It's got 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. It never needs gas, it takes up very little room, it's easy to install, easy to use, and virtually maintenance-free. And the bottles don't need to stay attached to the machine, so one Vinfinity can preserve an infinite number of wines. We now offer dozens of wines by the glass at Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, and because of Vinfinity, we know that every glass is right when it comes to you. Tell your favorite restaurant about the Vinfinity system. If you own a restaurant or bar, buy it. Go to VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953 and tell them the restaurant guys sent you. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Malcolm Lloyd, owner of Double Cross Vodka, about vodka, which is in a really fascinating place right now. Malcolm, down at Tales of the Cocktail with all the best cocktailians, bartenders, bar owners, restaurant owners concerned about cocktails in one place. People were talking about vodka a lot, and let's face it, if you're in the business, there was for a long time a prejudice against vodka. You'd walk into certain cocktail, really cool cocktail bars, and you'd say, oh, what do you have that's a vodka drink? And the bartender would say,
We don't
have
vodka
drinks, yeah.
And there are places that didn't even have vodka.
Or they have one vodka, and it was under the counter like a porno magazine, you know. that's all changed around, and one of the reasons it's changed around is that people sort of are inclined to ask for vodka drinks. And maybe we can bring them to the rye drinks and the rum drinks later on that we like. But if people want vodka drinks, there's no reason not to give it to them. So operators are realizing that there's a real revenue loss to not carry vodka, and also that there are some quality vodkas to have. Most of the vodkas out there have really big marketing budgets. Absolut, you see everywhere in magazines, spend a lot of money on those sort of marketing budgets. You're pursuing a different way. You're getting involved with the people who are cocktail people, high-end bar people, who sort of it's a brave way to go about marketing, because those people really were hostile to vodka when you first started marketing to them, and you're doing this without benefit of multi-million-dollar ad campaigns. You're trying to convince people more or less one at a time, word of mouth, that Double Cross is the way to go. Why that marketing strategy? How's that going to work for you? Is your vodka particularly suited to that? What's up with that?
Yeah, well, for starters, I happen to really enjoy the mixology world and those bars that take great care to make great drinks. So I'm sort of naturally drawn to them. So as you mentioned, it was a little bit difficult. It has been difficult at times going into some of these places and seeing vodka treated like you, as you suggested, a porn mag underneath the counter, if they had it at all. And I do agree that there is a bit of a new embrace. I mean, maybe embrace is too strong of a word, but I think there's an open-mindedness to some of the perhaps more handcrafted vodkas that are coming to market. And I think that while, yes, huge marketing budgets and ad campaigns, I mean, you even see a lot of television campaigns now, sometimes work to reinforce a very large brand. One, I don't think they work. Two, they're wildly expensive. And three, I think it's folks like yourself, it's other mixologists, it's these kinds of places that others turn to when they look to have the types of brands they want to drink be endorsed. And is it slow, and am I going to have a healthy dose of patience? I think the answer is yes, but what I want to create is a following behind the Double Cross. And I wouldn't even go to Tales of the Cocktail or to some of these mixology bars if I felt that we didn't have a product that could play well. Per our previous conversations, I think it does make, you know, a very nice vodka cocktail, and so it's not like I'm trying to promote something within the mixology world that is going to get rejected over and over again, and as if I'm trying to find a date.
There were almost no vodkas at Tales of the Cocktail. I mean, I can't think of another one other than yours.
Yeah, there were very, very few vodkas down there. I think there was a Grey Goose party. And I think the large commercial vodkas just really still probably don't fit in that world. But I, you know, there's a number of vodkas that I like beyond Double Cross that I think do and could have a presence at Tales of the Cocktail, and I've seen behind the bars at some of the higher end mixology places. Charbet is an example of a vodka I happen to like, and I like the flavors that they do, and I've seen them and you know, in a few mixology places as well. But I, you know, it's slow, but it's an enjoyable approach to marketing, because you get to interact with people who really, really care about this trade and this industry. And I firmly believe that if we can get some of them to adopt Double Cross, it will pay off in spades.
You know, it's funny. There are a couple of vodkas that I like, and frankly, I think all around, I would say that it's your vodka, Double Cross, Tito's, I really enjoy a great deal, and Ketel One. All three very different vodkas, which really belies the idea that, you know, well, gins are different, but vodkas are all the same, because they're not. And as far as this is concerned, if you want to try Double Cross, if you can get your hands on some Dolan dry vermouth, and Dolan is kind of hard to come by, but if you email us, francis@restaurantguysradio.com,
I'll
tell you where to get it. But a 50-50, you know, half Dolan dry vermouth, half Double Cross vodka is a great way to really look at the spirit in a cocktail where you have a lot of the character of a or any vodka. That's a great way to look at any vodka, because you have 50% vodka that's been sort of nudged a little bit in one direction and accented, maybe throw a little orange bitters on there or some aromatic bitters on there. But, you know, that's the way you need to look at a vodka. It's a subtle thing. It's a subtle, subtle thing. So you talked about, Malcolm, a moment ago, having some patience, which reminded me, I think one of the things that's fascinating about you is that I only came to learn after we'd first met. You're a biomedical engineer and a physician. That's your background, and you decided to throw that all away and go into vodka.
Vodka wasn't your first. Well, maybe it was your first love, but it wasn't your first profession.
It was not my first profession, and I did enjoy drinking vodka amongst other things, and it's an interesting sort of story as to how I got into this. I after graduating from, I went to Johns Hopkins as an undergraduate and studied biomedical engineering. And I think because I went there, I ended up going to medical school, just because virtually half the class ended up going to medical school. My friends were doing it, and I sort of fell in line, so to speak. Went to medical school, realized that I probably didn't have the passion for clinical medicine that others did. Ended up working for a venture capital firm that invested in biotechnology. And I think there was when I found that what I really enjoy is the entrepreneurial process. So I founded a company in the past, and in the Boston area. I had moved to New Jersey from Boston, really sort of kicking and screaming a little bit. And my godfather, who lives in Princeton, who's the co-founder of Double Cross Vodka, said that I could take up a room in his house and I wouldn't have to pay any rent, and I could come down and work in this pharmaceutical company that had offered me a job. And he was in the spirits business, and that's when I started to get interested in it. It was much more fun for when we were going out to dinner for us to talk about what was behind the back bar and why, and what he was selling and why, than me sharing the, you know, the cardiovascular clinical trials that I was designing with him.
Well, as a spirits guy, I have to say, talking to you about some of the cardiovascular stuff was pretty cool for me. I mean, it's pretty interesting stuff.
Now you, I mean, I don't want to sell you short here, because I think it's really fascinating that, you know, your creative process and your engineering, your love for engineering comes, you know, and you've really invented a vodka, and there are some processes that you do differently with Double Cross that are fascinating. But you have some inventions to your name from your biomedical engineering background.
I do. I started a company which is I would say it's more of a charitable mission at this point. But I've always believed that the physicians that are least likely to be courted by industry are often the most likely to identify the best new ideas or identify the problems with, for example, the tool sets they use for surgeons, for example. And
why is that? Why are the ones least likely to be courted by industry most likely to?
Because they're the ones that are working perhaps in a community surgical setting. They're the ones that that are doing the most numbers of surgeries. They're not out sort of quote unquote on the speaker circuit. They're not doing research in the lab 3 or 4 days a week. They're not teaching as much. So they're really in the thick of it. They're in the trenches, so to speak. They're the ones doing the most number of surgeries. And when something isn't going right with one of the devices they're using, they're most likely to find it. But yet they're not. They have the least resources with which to bring any of their problems to solutions.
So what are some of the inventions that you, and we talked a little bit before the show, but I want you to share with the audience some of the inventions that you came up with that really make the world a better place. I mean, it's fascinating to me.
And don't start with vodka.
I won't start with vodka. Since I've always believed that about those surgeons, I basically cast a net to capture some of their ideas. And I've sort of acted as a co-inventor, co-engineer, brought the ideas down to the biomedical engineering school at Johns Hopkins and given the problems to student teams to work with me to help engineer solutions. The first thing that we did about 4 years ago was I was working with a cardiovascular surgeon who felt that the way that the chest is closed after open-heart surgery is barbaric, using these sternal wires that can almost sort of create like a cheese wire effect through bone. They can pop, they're painful, they protrude, and we invented a new approach to closing the chest, which was a bioresorbable, effectively a zip tie is the best way to describe it. That was one of the things we invented. We also invented a syringe that when you go into place an indwelling catheter in the central venous system, you will know whether or not you hit an artery. Because if you hit an artery, that can be a big problem. You do not want to cannulate an artery, and it's something that can happen. And if it does, it can be devastating because arteries.
So how do you know? How do you know if you have used this syringe that you've invented?
You have essentially two chambers side by side. That have different diameters and therefore have different force characteristics in terms of the force with which the fluid will flow into the chambers, and basically the differential between those two will let you know if you're in a low pressure vein or a high pressure artery.
That's amazing.
Fascinating. That's great.
Well, I know it's not about the restaurant business and booze and stuff, but it's really fascinating. You also told us about a way to reduce pain for on surgical incision sites.
Yes. Another surgeon said, you know, this is crazy that after surgery, it's actually not what we did inside the patient's body. It's the incision itself that is keeping the patients in the hospital, because that's where the greatest amount of pain is being caused for the first 2 or 3 days afterwards. So they need to be on intravenous drips of opiates. And one way to avoid that, we envisioned, would be to have an inlay that you could lay just under the skin under a surgical wound that would elute a chemical, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, perhaps even a local anesthetic into that area for for a period of days, and getting the patients off of the systemic opiates, getting them out of the hospital, getting them mobilized. I mean, there's all sorts of bad side effects with having, you know, systemic anti-pain medications when the pain is local and it can be treated in a local setting.
And for those of you at home, the word elute will be on the quiz at the end of the show.
You know, so Malcolm Lloyd is actually Dr. Malcolm Lloyd. And I think we've established your smarty pants credibility here, Malcolm. That brings me to, I want to come back to vodka for 1 second, because there's something that your vodka advertises. Something that is often hokey is you hear about vodkas that are 9 times distilled and stuff that's charcoal filtered or filtered through, you know, the rock star's underpants, you know, all sorts of this thing about, you know, 9 times filtered, 9 times distilled. But you advertise that your vodka is filtered through diamond dust, which causes me great suspicion of who the hell cares. Were these diamonds once owned by Madonna? Why in the world would that make a difference?
Yeah, it's exactly that reaction, which is going to be the reason why we're not going to remove it from the process of making the product, but we are not going to talk about it in our advertising and marketing really anymore.
Really?
We've made that decision because...
It caused me great suspicion when I saw it, I'll be honest with you. But there's a reason you do it. Why do you do it?
Yeah, there is a reason we do it, and it does cause suspicion, and we don't want to cause that suspicion. It's a very genuine product offering. We want that to ring through and through. The reason we do it is because the irony of it is that I wasn't believing other vodka's stories with respect to the way they were filtering their vodka. Grey Goose talked about champagne limestone as being sort of the end-all, be-all of filtration. There's a vodka called Reka which I happen to like the vodka an awful lot, that filters through lava rock. And we all know about sort of the carbon filtration. And so I wanted to find out what really would be the ultimate filter for vodka. And so I went back and spoke to and interviewed filtration engineers and asked them what would really be, if you were trying to find the ultimate particulate remover, what would it be? And they informed me that it would be diamond dust, because of the way that the diamond dust shards stack up upon one another. They don't create a mush because they're so hard, and it creates a lattice that it's sort of difficult to describe over the phone, but it could create a lattice that captures any last little piece of particulate matter that might be in the vodka. So it doesn't remove impurities, so to speak, but it removes any sort of, it cleans the vodka. That was an irony for me, because I would have been racing to find out the answer to what the ultimate filter is even faster if I had heard someone was using diamonds or diamond dust in their filter.
Because you want to call bullshit.
It would have set off all kinds of red flags. But lo and behold, we ended up finding diamond dust dealers. I brought about 5,000 carats of it over to Slovakia, sat down with the master distiller. We built a filter. We felt that it was working, and so we're not going to take it out of the filtration process. We're just not going to talk about it anymore, because I don't want that reaction that Francis you had, and I totally understand where it comes from, because I had the same one when looking into other people's vodka.
Well, my thought was maybe they'd be better off putting a diamond in like one in every 100,000 bottles.
Take your chance to win a diamond. I like that.
Why did you choose Slovakia? Why this location? Because obviously you worked very hard at all the elements of choosing the whys and what fors of this vodka. Why Slovakia?
Initially agnostic to where. We just wanted to find the best producers of vodka, the best distilleries. And then as we found that there were many great distilleries that around the world that you could work with, we then decided we didn't want to be another Polish vodka. We didn't want to be another Russian, another French vodka. We happened to have some good relationships. I'd spent a summer when I was in medical school living in Prague, which is close to where the distillery is today. And we had the opportunity to spend a couple of weeks in Slovakia and virtually meet every distillery in that country. And really happened to find a couple of distilleries that we really liked and one we wanted to partner with. And that's kind of why Slovakia. From a marketing standpoint, it sort of is a clean canvas with which we can paint, because there's not a lot of images that are already in people's minds about what Slovakia is.
Well, the vodka is great. I think you're in a great position, and the work you do in your story is pretty darn fascinating. Thanks for coming to talk with us today, Malcolm.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
And Malcolm, one of the things I hope you learned while we were in New Orleans is people are always asking us the secret of how we have such a great guest list, and I think you learned the secret while we were down there.
I sure did, and. I can't wait to hear who's next.
For those of you in the audience, I will share with you, it's incriminating photos.
it's going out and drinking with everybody in the business is what it's all about. Hey, listen, I hope we'll be back in just a moment. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Wow!
I love the story.
That guy's smart.
I love the story of how people get into this business, because people get into the cocktail business, the spirits business, the restaurant beers business. There are so many interesting people in this world who came from such diverse backgrounds and
Mark.
Crazy places and smart places.
Not a lot of biomedical engineer physicians from Johns Hopkins who have invented surgical equipment. Not a lot of those guys.
You know, and basically being 80 to 100 pounds overweight, I should probably thank him for some of that hard stuff right now.
Sooner or later. Can I tell you, though, the thing about it is he's right about being drawn to people in the cocktail world, and he does fit in because he's fun, he's laid back. You know, one of the nice things about this.
And just as a guy who's met him, not pretentious at all, you'd never know that he was a fascinating medical researcher.
What's funny is if you met him and you hung out with him, and you know what? You know what I also like? You know what's really a sign of class? He doesn't bring it up, man.
Never.
He doesn't bring it because we hung out with him a couple times, and I think the reaction initially when we were at the bar and we had a couple of drinks, and I was like, "You are not," you know. But I like that about people. It's like you don't need to wear your heart on your sleeve or your accomplishments on your sleeve. You are who you are, and you know, it's I think that's really cool. I think that's really cool. And I see that at the bar as well, you know. It's you don't need to and you know, people meet each other at bars all the time, especially men looking to meet women or women looking to meet men. And I think a mistake that men make a lot in particular with other men and also if you're trying to meet a woman is to "Hi, I'm Bob.
The bravado.
I've done this, this, and this, and I've invented that, and that." I'm like, "Oh, Bob, I just wanted to say hello and have a drink. I don't give a rat's ass." You know, because I often think, I really do often think, I don't give a rat's ass. You know, whereas, you know, I think Malcolm is just the kind of guy we like.
He's an interesting guy, and he's got an interesting story. But it's not all about talking about himself. It's about being part of the conversation. It's really interesting vodka, but a super interesting guy too.
And I want everybody to understand. I've no mea culpas here for my former opposition to the obsession with vodka. I never had a problem with vodka itself. I had a problem with, and I still have a problem with the way that some people use vodka. And it's for image, and it's for status, and it's for people who are drinking drinks who want to get a buzz but don't like what alcohol tastes like. I think that's problematic. You know, I really do think that's problematic. But you know, like I said, I think that we're on the verge of a new dawn of how to use these things, and you need to be really careful. And I think it's only a talented mixologist that can make a really good vodka cocktail.
Oh, I think for sure.
But also, if you're out there, realize that some of your audience that asks for, if you're the bartender and somebody asks for a vodka drink, they may not want a 50-50. It's too strong. They may not want a Flame of Love martini. It's too strong. They may want cranberry juice and vodka.
And forcing somebody to drink what you want to drink,
all wrong,
is pretentious.
If you want cranberry juice, and if your customer wants cranberry juice and vodka, don't make them feel bad about it. Don't comment on it. Just get them a cranberry juice and vodka.
Get them what they want.
Oh, and take their $8. Anyway, and you know, and someday they may say, you know, "Hey, why don't you make me something?" And you can sort of ease them one way or another. Or maybe they won't. Maybe they'll. There's a guy, dear friend of ours, who drinks Johnny Walker
Red
and water.
All the time.
That's what he's drunk.
Forever.
That's his drink. I see him walk in the door. We start making his drink. And a couple of times I got him to try a couple of other scotches. He drank an Irish whiskey once on my birthday.
That was a gift to you.
This guy has been a regular customer of ours and has become a dear, dear, dear friend for 20 years. And you know what? That's what he wants to drink. Leave the man alone.
Right.
Actually, it's funny. My joke, when he walks into the bar and I'm behind the bar all the time, he's like, who shall remain nameless? So, Bob. Grasshopper?
Whiskey
sour? And he'll say, "Yeah, Francis." And I put down a scotch and water in front of him. Anyway, I am just a great bartender, man. Anyway.
Remember we were talking about how it's pretentious to talk about yourself?
Well, yeah. I did it at the end of the conversation.
Okay.
Anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed the hour as much as we have. We are the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.